the world's great novel. During the second half of the 19th century, a woman novelist came into prominence who saw life through the lenses of insight, fearlessly told what she saw, and with these abilities won a place in the literature of England. The National Broadcasting Company presents the first in a two-part version of George Eliot's Silas Marner, another in our series of books that live the world's great novel. This story is laid in the English village of Ravelo near the end of the 18th century. It is named for one of the central characters, Silas Marner, the weaver of Ravelo. Let me tell you a little about the early life of Silas Marner that you may better understand his later years. At 25, in a town in the English Midlands, Silas' lot was a happy, though uneventful one. He was gaining skill as a linen weaver and had the inner peace of an ardent religious faith. He was engaged to a young servant woman named Sarah and enjoyed the friendship of a certain William Dane. Because of Silas' trusting simplicity, William seemed faultless. It never crossed his mind to doubt any of his friend's motives. But just at this time, the senior deacon of the church was taken dangerously ill. Being a childless widower, he was tended by the younger brethren or sisters. Silas took his watch at 11 at night, with William relieving him at 2. But one night...
Oh. 4 o'clock. How could it be so late? Well, I must have fallen asleep. I wonder why William has not come. I'd better see if the deacon wants for anything. Well, he seems to be sleeping so... Oh. His heart? He's passed away while I was fast asleep.
Later that morning, while Silas sat at his loom, William and the minister appeared, summoning him to the church. The reason for this meeting he did not learn until he was seated in the vestry facing the minister.
Silas Marner, I have here in my hand a pocket knife. Do you know to whom it belongs?
Why, of a certainty, it is mine.
And do you recall where you left this knife?
Well, I did not know I left it anywhere outside of my own pocket.
I exhort you, Silas, not to hide your sin, but to confess and repent. You know your religion does not believe in punishment. We only want you to beg forgiveness.
Forgiveness? For what?
The church money, which our dear departed deacon kept, was stolen last night.
Oh!
And this knife was found by the place where the money had been.
You don't think I took the money? Oh, surely not.
Who, if not the man to whom the knife belongs? The proof is heavy against you, Marner. The money was taken in the night just past, and no man was with our departed brother but you. For William Dane declares to us that he was hindered by sudden illness from going to take his place as usual.
Yes, but I fell into a deep sleep for almost 2 hours. The thief must have come and gone during that time. Don't you believe me? Oh, William, for the 9 years that we have been friends, has you ever known me to tell a lie?
Brother, how do I know what you may have done in the secret chambers of your heart to give Satan an advantage over you?
But, William... Oh, wait, I remember now. William, the knife wasn't in my pocket last night.
Why do you address me? I know nothing of what you speak.
The last time I used my knife was when I took it out to cut a strap for you, William, and you took it.
Why, Silas, I gave it straight back to you.
No! No, I never put it back in my pocket again. You stole the money, and you have woven a plot to lay the sin at my door.
I leave our brethren to judge whether this is the voice of Satan or not.
Oh!
I can do nothing but pray for your silence.
Silas left the church in despair, his trust shaken in God and man. A few hours later, the minister came to him with the message that Sarah held her engagement to him at an end. Within a month, Sarah was married to William Dane, and Silas Marner departed from the town. Now 15 years since Silas Marner had come to Raveloe, and the impressions the people garnered of him on his arrival had only been enforced through the years.
Have you ever been to his cottage near the stone pit?
No, and I've no anchoring to go if it is cold and strange as its inhabitant.
I've never known him to speak so sociable word to any creature. Does seem it get lonely shut up there by himself for all these years.
Ah, it is natural to a hermit, I suppose. And I'm bound that's what he is.
Of course, we housewives depend on him in a fashion, for he does weave linen of the finest sort. But his dress is so shabbily and looks so ill-fed, I do feel sorry for him at times.
Ah, save your pity. He dresses and eats in a manner that suits him. Do you not pay him a good price for his weaving?
Aye.
Well, so does every other housewife about. Yes, I tell you, Master Marner has laid by a fine sight of money, Summers. But what he intends to do with it, I can't figure me.
Silas intended to do nothing with his wealth but keep it. His life reduced itself to the mere functions of weaving and hoarding. He kept his gold in two large leather bags under some loose stones in the floor. We must now learn something of the people who lived in the big red house on the hill. It was the home of Squire Cass, a widower, and his four sons. It was known that all the Cass boys led an idle life, but the second one, Dunstan, was by far the worst of the lot. He was a conscienceless, irresponsible fellow who took great delight in the fact that he was able to blackmail his brother, Godfrey.
My good brother, Godfrey, sent word that he wanted to see me. And since he is my elder and better, I was obliged to bide his summons.
If you'll just shake yourself sober and listen, I'll tell you what I want. I have to turn that rent money of Fowler's over to Father. I can't delay any longer. So get the money or I'll have to tell him I gave it to you.
Oh, suppose now you just get the money yourself and save me the trouble, eh? Since you were so kind as to hand it over to me, you'll not refuse me the kindness to pay it back for me. Besides, I might get you turned out of house and home and cut off without a shilling any day, you know.
Why?
Yes, all I'd have to do is to explain to the squire why his eldest and handsomest son doesn't ask the lovely Miss Nancy Lameter to marry him, like everyone in the village expects him to. I'd only have to tell him it's because you're already married and have been for nearly 2 years to that nice young woman, Molly Farnham, whom you've managed to keep hidden away in another town. Of course, she does take a drop too much now and then to ease her lot, but...
Don't talk so loud.
All right. But you will get £100 for me, won't you?
I tell you, I have no money, and old Kimball won't loan me anymore.
Well, then sell that horse of yours. Sell Wildfire.
That's easy talking. I must have money directly.
Well, you have only to ride him to the hunt tomorrow. Bryce and Keating will be there, and they'll give you a handsome bid for him.
And I wouldn't get home till 8 o'clock and be splashed up to the chin. I'm going to Mrs. Osgood's birthday dance.
Oh-ho. And sweet Nancy will be there, and we shall dance with her and smile at her and never even whisper that we have a wife and child.
Hold your tongue about Miss Nancy, you fool, or I'll throttle you.
What for? She was angry with you for the long time you was absent while you was getting married, thinking you was off in some sort of carouse. But I'm sure you can win her favor again. Of course, it'd be saving time if Molly should happen to take a drop too much someday and make a widower of you.
It's just like you to talk about my selling Wildfire in that cool way. The last thing I've got to call my own, and the best bit of horse flesh I ever had in my life. It's my belief you'd sell yourself if it was only for the pleasure of making somebody feel he'd got a bad bargain.
For which reason, I advise you to let me sell Wildfire. I'd ride him to the hunt for you tomorrow with pleasure.
I dare say. Trust my horse to you.
As you please, as you please. It's you have got to pay Fowler's money. You received the money from him when you went to Brancombe. And you told the squire it wasn't paid. I had nothing to do with that.
You mean no nonsense about the horse? You'll tell him all fair and hand over the money?
I thought you'd come around. I'm the fella to bring old Bryce up to the scratch. I'll get 120 for him if I get you a penny.
Well, take care to keep sober tomorrow. Else you'll get pitched on your head. And Wildfire might be the worst for it.
Make your tender heart easy. You never knew me to see double when I'd got a bargain to make. Spoil the fun. Well, good day, my dear brother Godfrey.
Hey there, Dunsey.
Good afternoon, Bryce.
Sure. Come on. You're on your brother's horse today. How's that?
Oh, I've swapped with him. Wildfire's mine now.
Oh? Has he swapped with you for that big-boned hack of yours?
Oh, there was a little account between us, and Wildfire made it even.
Yeah.
I'll keep him now. Though I had a bid of 150 for him the other day. Man over at Flinton, buying for Lord Plumbeck.
I wonder at that now. I never heard of a man who didn't want to sell his horse getting a bid of half as much again as the horse was worth. You'll be lucky if you get to 100.
Oh, boy. Well, Dudsey, right.
Afternoon, Keating.
Glad you rode up, Keating. You can perhaps settle this argument. Bryce here doesn't think Wildfire's worth more than 100.
Are you considering selling him?
Well, now, I hadn't been, but if I found a man who knew his worth and felt he'd care for him the way he should be, well, now, perhaps...
The transaction, just as Dunsey planned it, ended in the purchase of the horse by Bryce for 120, to be paid on the delivery of Wildfire, safe and sound. It did occur to Dunsey that it might be wise for him to give up the day's hunting, but the inclination for a run with Wildfire, encouraged by a draft of brandy at the close of the bargain, was not easy to overcome. He swept over the hills at a high speed, and then he came unexpectedly upon a tall fence. Dunstan got up without a scratch, but poor Wildfire lay dead.
Which lane is this, I guess? Taking a shorter way home. Hey, it is a fog. There's a house right in front of me, and I've not even noticed it before. Small stone cottage. Belonged to the Miser Manor. I wonder if it's true that the old fool has stores of gold hidden in there. Yeah, perhaps I shall just go up and pay the old man a neighborly visit. To bed. But then why would he leave the lights on? What's there? Door open. And not a soul within. The fire's lighted and a piece of meat hangs on a spit. Well, wherever the old man's gone, he'll be back soon. Unless, of course, in this dark night he slipped into the stone pit. Wouldn't that be a tragedy, with all his gold waiting here for him? And where do you suppose that gold might be? Where would I hide a fortune in such a place? Very interesting. Stone seems loose. Oh, much looser than the others. Two leather bags.
Gold. Two bags filled with gold.
Oh, I've got to get out of here quickly.
The gathering at the Rainbow was small this night, many personages being at Mrs. Osgood's birthday dance, as was Godfrey Cat.
But the group who assembled there were engaged in animated conversation as they drank their spirits and smoked their pipes near the open fire.
But isn't it true, Mr. Macy, that those old stables on the Warren Place are never used anymore?
And for particular reason?
Aye, aye. Strange things go on there. They're haunted from the days of the Warren family. Go that way of a dark night and then make believe, if you like, as you didn't see lights in the stables and hear the stamp of the horses in that deserted place.
And what do you say to that, Dallas? You're always a doubting one.
I say I'll wager any man £10 if he'll stand out with me any dry night in the pasture before the Warren stables, that we shall see no lights nor hear noises, if it isn't the blowing of our own nose. And I've said that many times. But there's nobody who'll venture a tenpin on their gosses. Now, if gosses want me to believe in them, let them leave off skulking in darkening and lone places. Let them come where there's company and candles.
As if gosses would want to be believed in by anyone so ignorant.
Dallas, it looks to me like a ghost has decided to seek company.
Oh, my soul. It's Silas Marner.
Why does he stand like a madman staring at us?
Master Marner, what's lacking to you? What's your business here?
Robbed. Huh? I've been robbed. Oh. I want the constable and the justice and Squire Cass and Mr. Crackenthorpe.
He's off his head, no doubt. He's went through.
Come, come, Master Marner. If you've got any information to lay, speak it out sensible.
Aye, man.
I have been given a piece of pork by Miss Priscilla Lamater. When I took her some linen today, and I used the string which fastens the latch on my door to tie the meat to the spit.
Uh-huh.
Then, as I waited for it to cook, I recollected that I needed a bit of fine twine to set up a new piece on my loom for work the next morning. I decided I'd fetch it right off while my supper cooked. I didn't lock my door on account of using the latch string on the meat, and I was gone such a little time, but... A thief come and took my gold, all my beautiful gold. I don't accuse anybody. I only want my gold back.
Oh, how much money might there be, Master Marner?
£272.12 last night when I counted it.
What I vote is the two of us should go with Master Marner to Master Kench, the constable. He's ill abed, and get him to appoint one of us his deputy, for that's the law. And then we'll start investigating this matter.
I don't want to jail anybody. I don't want to bring charges. I just want it back. My gold. Get me back my gold.
By the next morning, the whole village was talking about the robbery. But not a trace of the thief was to be found. And no one connected the disappearance of Duncy Cass with the theft. For he was away as much as he was at home anyhow. But when a week passed without a sign of Duncy and the carcass of Wildfire had been found, Godfrey realized he had again been tricked by his brother. He waited for his father in the dining room one morning.
What, sir? Haven't you had your breakfast yet?
Yes, sir. But I was waiting to speak to you.
Well, get to it while I'm waiting for my ale.
Well, sir, there has been a cursed piece of ill luck with Wildfire.
What? What happened?
He's been staked and killed.
What?
But I wasn't thinking of asking you to buy me another horse.
Oh.
I was only thinking I had lost the means of paying you with the price of Wildfire as I'd meant to do.
Huh?
Dunsey took him to the hunt to sell him for me. But after he'd made a bargain for £120 with Bryce, he went after the hounds and took some fool's leap that did for the horse that won.
I don't... What? Will you kindly tell me what all this is about, sir?
The truth is, sir... Well... You see, Fowler did pay that £100 rent.
Oh?
He paid it to me when I was over there one day last month.
Oh?
And Dunsey bothered me for the money, and I let him have it.
You let Dunsey have it, sir?
Yes.
Why should you let him have it? There's some lie at the bottom of this. Where is Dunsey?
Dunsey hasn't come back, sir.
What? Did he break his own neck, then?
No, I don't think he was hurt. But the horse was found dead, and Dunsey must have walked over.
You... I've been too good a father to you all, that's what it is. But I shall pull up, sir.
I've often offered, sir, to take the management of things. But you know you've taken it ill always and seem to think I wanted to push you out of your place.
I know nothing of that, but I know one thing. While you were thinking of marrying, I didn't put any obstacles in your way, as some fathers would. No, I'd as leave you marry Lammeter's daughter as anybody. I... The lass hasn't said downright she won't have you, has she?
No, but I don't think she will.
Think? Ha! Why haven't you the courage to ask her? Stick to it if you want to have her.
There's no other woman I want to marry.
Well, then, I know Lammeter well. Let me make the offer for you.
I'd rather let it be, please, for the present.
Eh?
I hope you won't try to hurry it on by saying anything.
You can't let this matter ride on like this forever. I'll expect you to ask her. When we have our annual New Year's Eve ball here. Yes. There couldn't be a better occasion.
It was now New Year's Eve. Silas Marner sat desolate and alone in his cottage, working feverishly at his loom to keep from thinking of his great loss. No one could have been less interested in the holiday party that was then beginning in the Red House. As the young ladies of the village arrived, they went directly to an upstairs room to remove their flowing capes and freshen up their toilets before descending to the ballroom. At this moment, the Mrs. Priscilla and Nancy Lammeter were viewing themselves in a polished mirror.
Lord, Nancy, look at me in a silver silk. I look as yellow as a daffodil. Folk will think I'm 10 years older than you instead of 5. I told you how to be.
But, Prissy, I begged and prayed of you not to let me have this silk if you'd like another better.
Nonsense, child. You know you take your heart in this.
What I find fault with is that notion of yours, as I must dress myself just like you, Prissy. I'm sure I'm willing to give way as far as is right, but who shouldn't dress alike if a certain sister? Now, I'd do what was right if I dressed in a gown dyed of cheese coloring, and I'd rather you choose and let me wear what pleases you.
There you go again. You'd come round to the same thing if one talked to you from Saturday night till Saturday morning. Oh, it'll be fine fun to see how you'll master your husband and never raise your voice above the singing of a kettle all the while.
No, don't talk so, Prissy. You know I don't mean ever to be married.
Oh, you never mean a fiddlestick then. Why, who shall I have to work for when father's gone? If you're to go and take notions in your head and be an old maid, because some folks are no better than they should be.
Old people should be good. All people can't be as good as you, my pet. Particularly a man like Mr. Godfrey Cass. Why bring his name up?
Oh, you can't pretend. Oh, come on, let's go down now. I'm as ready as a mawkin can be. And there's nothing I want in to frighten the crows. Now I've got my ear bobs in.
Poor Godfrey was a pitiable mixture of fear, elation, and despair that night. He remembered his father's wish that this party would bring about an understanding between Nancy Lammeter and him. And though he knew this was impossible, the sight of the beautiful girl in her silver satin set his head spinning.
Good evening, Dr. Kimball.
Oh, Miss Nancy, what a picture you look tonight. You won't forget your promise. You're to save a dance for me, you know.
Come, Kimball. Don't you be too foreign. Give the young un fair play. There's my son, Godfrey. He's bespoken for the first dance, I'll be bound, eh, sir?
Well, no, I've not asked her yet, but I hope she'll consent if somebody else hasn't been before me. Now, Miss Nancy?
No, I've not engaged myself.
Then I hope you've no objection to dancing with me?
No. No objection.
Ah, well, you're a lucky fellow, Godfrey. But you're my godson, so I won't stand in your way.
Oh, Dr. Kimball.
Well, go ahead, sir. The music will have ended before you've begun.
Oh, yes, Miss Nancy, my arm.
Thank you.
There's the match.
There's Godfrey dancing with Miss Nancy, darling. Fine couple they make.
That they do, Mr. Macy. Yet I think that Godfrey's got a soft place in his head. Else why should he be turned round the finger by that awful dancing nobody's seen of late? And let him kill that fine auntie Norse, eh?
Well, true. And another queer thing is how once he was always hanging after Miss Nancy, and then it come off again. Like a smell of hot porridge, as you might say. Squire. That wasn't my way when I was a courting.
Aye, but may have Miss Nancy young off like. And your last didn't, eh?
I should say she didn't. Before I said snip, I took Harris to know she'd say snap. And pretty quick, too. I wasn't going to open my mouth like a dog at a fly and snap it to a gale with nothing to swallow.
Oh, I think mayhap Miss Nancy's coming round again. But Master Godfrey doesn't look so downhearted tonight. And I see he's for taking her away to sit down. That looks like sweethearting, that does.
I'm very sorry to interrupt our dance, Mr. Godfrey, but the hem seems to have come out of my skirt in the bath, and I shall have to go sit down till my sister comes to mend it for me. I'm sorry to make myself troublesome. I'm sorry you've had such an unlucky partner.
That's very ill natured of you, to be sorry you've danced with me.
Oh, no, sir, I don't mean to say what's ill natured at all. When gentlemen have so many pleasures, one dance can make but very little difference.
You know that isn't true. You know one dance with you matters more to me than all the other pleasures of the world.
No, indeed, Mr. Godfrey. That's not known to me. And I have very good reasons for thinking different.
Would you never forgive me then, Nancy? Never think well of me? Would you never think the present made amends for the past? Not if I turned a good fellow and gave up everything you didn't like?
I should be glad to see a good change in anybody, Mr. Godfrey. But it would be better if no change was wanted. Oh, here comes my sister now.
Then I suppose I must go. Do you want me to go?
I do like, Mr. Godfrey.
Then I'd like to stay. And I'll the next dance.
While Godfrey Cass was letting the presence of Nancy erase everything else from his mind for the moment, Godfrey's wife was walking with slow, uncertain steps through the snow-covered Ravelo Lane toward the red house, carrying her child in her arms. Silas Marner by George Eliot is one of the world's great novels, brought to you each week by the National Broadcasting Company. Listen next week to the final episode of Silas Marner, and remember that there is a world of entertainment and instruction to be had in your local public library. To enhance your enjoyment of this series, we recommend the Handbook of the World's Great Novels, which you may obtain by sending 25 cents to World's Great Novels, Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27, New York. That's Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27. Silas Marner is adapted for radio by Agnes Eckhart. The music was composed by Emil Soderstrom, and the orchestra was directed by Bernard Berkowitz. The entire production was under the direction of Homer Heck. Jack Lester is the narrator. Silas Marner is played by Arthur Peterson. Nancy by Geraldine Kay. Dunsey by Jim Hummelin, Godfrey by Everett Clark, Priscilla by Ruth Shames, Squire Cass by Sherman Marks, Macy by Jess Pugh, Dowlas by Cliff Norton, Winthrop by George Kluge, and Dr. Kimball by Les Spears. This is John Conrad. This program comes to you from Chicago and is a presentation of the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent station. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.